Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While we may not remember birthdays or much from high school chemistry or civics class, just about any American born between 1950 and 1985 can sing every word to this song.
The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour. A three-hour tour.
Whether it's a catchy theme song like Gilligan's Island or an image, think Mary Tyler Moore tossing her cap into the air. Some memorable screen sequences far outlast the shows they open. TV critic Alan Sepinwall and his colleagues at HitFix compiled a list of the 25 greatest TV opening sequences of all time. He joins me now with the elements of a truly great opening sequence. Alan Sepinwall is also the author of the book The Revolution Was Televised. And Alan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. I knew exactly what song you were going to play as soon as you started talking about
it. How'd you guess?
It's just that's one in the DNA. The only other even possibility was Brady Bunch, which is also a Sherwood Schwartz show. There were a lot of shows like those in the 60s and the 70s, respectively, that were of comparable quality and style, but those two survived because everybody remembers those songs.
Well, I got to say, I noticed some personal favorites were not on your list, but I'm going to dive right into what you and your colleagues came up with. According to HitFix, what is the number one opening sequence?
The Simpsons.
What puts it at the top?
Well, I think part of it is people love The Simpsons, but also just it's the Danny Elfman score. You get this just collage of life in Springfield, so many images going by so quickly, so many gags packed into it, even more so the last few years since the show shifted to a high-def version of the credits. So there's just so much information and comedy packed in there and a sense of the show on top of this score, which, you know, is 25, 26 years old now and still holds up and still completely conveys the show.
All right. So what purpose should a great opening sequence serve?
It should do a few things. One, it should make you excited to watch the show that follows. You know, there's a lot of really bad shows I grew up watching in the 1980s that it didn't matter the quality of them because I was just so into the theme song, you know, Greatest American Hero, T.J. Hooker, you know, Magnum, things like that. So that should be one. Two, ideally, it should either give you a sense of what the show is about, whether that's a basic plot explanation like you get from something like Gilligan's Island, or, you know, something that conveys the mood of the show, like Rockford Files, which is sort of wistful and wry and funny, and it's not like we're going to be taking this private detecting thing too seriously. Or sometimes you just want something that's really interesting to look at and listen to. HBO had this show called John from Cincinnati, which premiered the night that The Sopranos ended, and nobody liked it, and nobody could understand it, and yet you watched the opening credit sequence, and it's fabulous and it's hypnotic, and you kind of wish that the show that followed had lived up to that.
All right, let's dig into some of those, the three categories that you just mentioned. First, opening credits as expository device. So that's, you're kind of telling the story. The Beverly Hillbillies tells you what happened. Jed, you know, found a stream of bubbling crude and moves with his crew to Beverly Hills. Here's another one, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Let's listen.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground is where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cooling, all shooting some b-ball outside of the school. When a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, you're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel-Air.
It seems to me, Alan, that this category has somewhat fallen out of fashion. What do you think?
Well, I think in general, opening credits have fallen out of fashion, especially on the broadcast networks, where the number of commercials that you have in every hour of television is so much greater now than it was even in the early 90s when The Fresh Prince came on, that the creators of these shows have to basically decide, do I want to devote 60 to 90 seconds to a catchy theme song, or do I want to devote those 60 to 90 seconds to packing in more story and more jokes? And in almost every case, they pick the story and the jokes, and I understand why. And so that means big opening credit sequences are almost entirely the province of cable shows now, and they don't make shows like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on HBO or FX.
Then the other category, opening credits as explicator of theme. Here is one fine, enduring example, the theme from Star Trek.
Space, a final frontier.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Okay, so that's kind of an explainer, but it also gives us the theme.
Yeah, it gives you a sense of what the show is about, not just in terms of here are these guys on this mission, but just the scope of the show, and we're going to explore and we're going to see what happens. And a lot of times what will happen is we'll come upon an alien planet where the aliens have weird ridges on their foreheads or are reenacting some period of American history so we can use costumes from the studio's trunk. But regardless, the credit sequence gives you this sense of grandeur that the show sometimes lived up to and sometimes did not.
How about opening credits as setter of mood? This was your other category. What are some examples of that?
Do you remember shows like Full House and Perfect Strangers
uh-huh.
in the 80s?
Yeah.
Those would always have these big sweeping scores and, you know, sappy music and people, you know, going out to the park or they're sailing on a boat on Lake Michigan or whatever. And it really didn't necessarily convey the mood of the show itself, but it created this idea of how they wanted you to feel. So they want you to feel attached to Cousin Larry and Balky or Uncle Jesse and the rest of the Full House gang and think, these are part of my family and I'm excited. And there's something emotional here, even though the actual show is just full of wacky hijinks for the most part.
We're talking about some of the most persistent earworms ever to hit American popular culture, the TV opening theme song. TV critic Alan Sepinwall is with us. He and his colleagues at HitFix came up with a list of the 25 greatest opening sequences of all time, including this one.
No one told you that was gonna be this way. Job's a joke, you broke. Your love life's the away. It's like you're always stuck in second gear.
That cast went through many hairstyles and many different looks over the years, and they never changed that original theme because the shots of them playing in the fountain and having fun were really all they ultimately needed.
That just reminded me of how often there are songs that we associate with the program. They can be so beloved, like I'm thinking Everybody Knows Your Name from Cheers, for example,
sure.
or The Sopranos. But those musicians never really transcended those television shows. I mean, it's not as if they became pop hits. They just seem confined to this universe of TV shows.
Well, I mean, I remember hearing the Friends theme on the radio a lot in the 90s and the Cheers theme a lot on the radio in the 80s, and certainly Greatest American Hero became a pop hit. I had the 45 record of that forever. So it does happen on occasion. It doesn't happen as much anymore, but, you know, the Rembrandts who did that Friends theme, they were able to ride that success for a little bit, and it to show how sticky that theme is, when it started playing and they get to the point where you're supposed to clap, I clapped. I could not stop myself.
So did everybody in the studio.
Yep.
Alan, what role, when I think of great opening sequences today, I think of HBO, you know, some terrific opening sequence programs from The Sopranos, from 6 Feet Under. What role did HBO play in reviving the art of the title sequence?
They played a big role because, again, around the time that HBO started making these original series like Oz and The Sopranos and Sex and the City in the late 90s, the networks had already started moving away from the credits. So the only place for a while where you could do these was on this channel that didn't have commercials. And so you've got 60 whole minutes to play with, and almost none of these shows are ever 60 minutes long. So that's now become, you know, something you expect from HBO shows, and sometimes it's disappointing when they don't live up to that. Deadwood is one of the greatest HBO shows ever, and I watch that, and every single time you get up to the opening credits, I kind of look away and do something else and wait for them to be over, which I don't feel about Sopranos or more recently something like True Detective.
In terms of music, what are some of the most memorable theme songs in television history?
Rockford Files, MASH, Hawaii Five-O, Friends theme, definitely Cheers theme, Addams Family, Batman, a lot of ones from the 60s, the Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and absolutely the two from the Sherwood Schwartz shows, Gilligan's Island and Brady Bunch. Those shows will in some way live on long past either of us just because of those two songs.
Well, Alan Sepinwall, thank you so much for walking us down TV's memory lane.
Thanks for having me.
TV critic Alan Sepinwall, he and his colleagues at HitFix compiled a list of the 25 greatest TV opening sequences of all time. And we do have a link to read the complete list and watch some of them for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.
Here's a story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of
Okay, up next, the story of Melissa Lee, who accidentally shattered her neighbor's window when she was 13 years old. For the next 22 years, she remained silent, and the window remained unfixed. Up next, we're going to hear what happens when an adult fesses up to a teenage crime. That's when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's plenty of evidence that teenagers sometimes do dumb things. Sometimes they get caught. Sometimes they get away with it. Or in this case, they get away with it for 22 years. This story comes to us from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible.
My name's Melissa Lee, and originally I'm from Hastings-on-Hudson, New York.
In a small town, I suppose you have to make your own fun.
Everybody makes their own fun. If you don't make it yourself, it ain't fun, it's entertainment.
I guess the big activity would be walking downtown after school, and you could hang out by the wall and watch people that you knew go by.
So not a lot going on in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York.
It's about 2 square miles, but it's right outside New York City, so it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot out there to do, but there's not actually a lot to do right where I was.
Besides people watching, Melissa and her friends would also collect geodes.
We did collect geodes, yes.
You know about geodes, right?
Break your own geodes.
The rocks are brown and lumpy on the outside, but when you smash them apart,
inside would be some crystalline structures. And you have no idea from the outside what you're getting. So you kind of have to take a chance on it, that inside you've got something great.
Usually Melissa and her friend Liz would buy a few geodes at the store downtown and take them home and smash them apart with a hammer. But one day, when Melissa was 13...
We were too impatient and we just had to know what was inside. There was a parking lot nearby and with an apartment building, and we decided to just throw it against the side of the wall as hard as we could and hope that it would crack open that way. And I think that was the first time that we had tried to open them that way without a hammer, just by throwing it. So I threw mine a few times, and finally it did crack open against the wall. And Liz kept throwing hers, and it wouldn't crack open. There was only one little window in this whole back of this apartment building. My friend Liz kept throwing hers, and...
just a big expanse of brick.
And Liz kept throwing hers, and it wouldn't crack open. So I threw mine, and we saw it going towards the window, and then...
I mean, it felt like it was slow motion.
Her aim just went wild, and...
we're kind of like, no!
Then the geode
went through the window.
Went right through the window. Breaking the glass and shattering it everywhere. We heard this huge crashing sound. Glass had broken and was now lying all over the parking lot floor, and the geode was inside. My first reaction was just pure, full-on fear. I hated doing things wrong. I hated getting in trouble. And I just got that terrible sinking feeling in my stomach, and I just wanted to get out of there. We were such good kids. I mean, this is what we did for fun. We broke open geodes. We never did anything wrong. And now we had committed this heinous act. And it was sort of like the quintessential wrong thing that kids can do. I mean, I always saw, you know, TV shows or read comic books where kids would break a window.
I get it.
And then they were faced with a dilemma. Do they go back and tell the guy that they did it or not?
Hey, let's get out of here.
We froze for about 10 seconds. And then my friend Liz ran forward. She reached into the broken glass and grabbed the geode, and we both ran. After initially running, some sort of moral compass started up, and we realized that we had to go back and we had to find this person and tell them what we did.
Melissa and Liz went back to the apartment building.
And we tried to figure out where the window led to. But when we went around to the front, it was very confusing which door might lead to that window. And so we knocked on a few doors. Everyone whose door we knocked on said that it wasn't their window. You know, we probably did that for 10 minutes. And then I think we were like, well, I think we did all that we can do. And we were probably really glad that we tried, but we weren't able to find out whose window it was in the end.
Still feeling guilty, Melissa avoided downtown and the window for a couple of months, which wasn't easy in a small town.
I thought that we would just go about our business and somebody would fix the window and I would never have to think about it again.
But when Melissa finally did go back to the window, it was still broken.
Like a cartoon, just like a, you know, jagged edge hole that was sitting there. Even the glass shards that had fallen into the parking lot were still lying there. It was pretty much like in pristine condition from the day that we had broken it until months and months later. It stayed almost exactly the same.
It was clear that the apartment was occupied.
Actually, we could see a TV on inside sometimes, so we knew somebody did live there. And sometimes the window would be raised up or lowered down, so someone was moving this window around, but the hole was always still in it. We just could not even imagine who this person was that wasn't doing anything to fix this window. They weren't even putting tape over it, and we'd even go by in the winter and see that the hole was still there.
The window stayed broken as Melissa finished middle school, then finished high school.
It just hadn't gone away like I wanted it to.
Then went away to college.
And I was shocked to find that it was still broken, even after I'd left town.
And this became the pattern for Melissa. She'd go away, do some growing up, but when she came home, she'd see that window and feel exactly like the 13-year-old kid she was when she broke the window.
When I think about 13, that's like my most awkward, horrible age. The sight of this window would just bring me right back to feeling like a middle schooler again.
Melissa is 36 now. Think of all the milestones you pass between 13 and 36.
I went away to college for 4 years, and by the end of that, I felt pretty grown up.
Came home, saw the window, felt like a 13-year-old.
And then after that, I traveled the world for 9 months.
Came home, saw the window, felt like a 13-year-old.
I went to graduate school.
Came home.
I moved to Washington, D.C.
Saw the window.
I got married.
You get the idea.
As much as I was changing, this part of my past was completely frozen. As soon as I saw the window, I was just brought right back to those middle school days when we had broken it.
So in 2011...
when I'm about 35 years old...
22 years after she and her friend broke the window...
I decide to find out once and for all whose window it is and apologize. And I guess, you know, offer to pay for it as well. Now I'm recording this
time
for real.
I don't
want
to be mean to you.
So, I go downtown with my sister accompanying me for courage. The hole is still there in the window. And my heart is beating so fast.
Should I just say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. I believe that, like, I know who broke that window.
He's right there.
Okay.
And I very, very nervously blurt out,
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to bother you. I'm just trying to actually make amends for... I think that years ago, I'm not sure, but I think my friend and I broke that window, and so I kind of just wanted to make amends for it.
You broke it?
I think so.
And you're telling me now?
Well, I actually tried to find you at the time, and I couldn't find you, and then 20 years later, I came back to my hometown. I left, you know, I haven't been back since then, and basically, that's what happened. So I just wanted to kind of find out, you know, whose it was, and...
Hi, Dina. How you doing?
How are you?
Good. She's been looking for me 20 years. She just said she found me. You believe it? For 20 years.
Well, I left town for a while.
But he didn't want to talk to me. He thought it was amusing that I was now fessing up. And when I offered to pay for it, he said...
This window?
No, don't worry.
No? I'm surprised.
It's been like that so long.
I know. Well, why did you just decide to leave it like that? Get a nice breeze in the back there?
The landlord was supposed to fix it.
The landlord had never fixed it?
He never did. Well, he was looking for a person that did it.
And when I offered to pay for it, he said no, that he'd gotten used to it. He just left it.
I grew into that broken window, you did. In fact, I love it. I wouldn't get it fixed for nothing.
Anyway, I'm sorry, but I'm glad that you've come to like the broken window. My name is Melissa, by the way.
Okay.
Thank you. It was nice to meet you after all these years. I've wondered about it.
That's kind of an understatement.
Whatever it was that was keeping me, you know, stuck in middle school there was sort of keeping him stuck with this broken window. And he just was content to live with it.
The broken windows theory proposed in 1982 says that a seemingly small act of vandalism, if it goes unfixed, can precipitate further vandalism and even more serious crime. That really didn't happen here, except for Melissa's life on the lam for 20 years. But the broken window did weigh on Melissa, and I'm guessing it affected the man in the apartment more than he's letting on, and a random passerby less so, and Hastings on Hudson, New York soldiered on without missing a beat. Architecture is personal. The strangest part of our interaction with the built environment is what can be so evocative and meaningful for you can mean absolutely nothing to someone else.
This time when I was in town, I just didn't really even... I think I was even in town for a few days before I even thought about the window. I didn't really even wonder about it very much. And then in the end, I didn't even go down and look.
And that story from Roman Mars and his podcast, 99% Invisible. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Booker T. Washington, Marian Anderson, all prominent figures in African-American history. But what about chess master Theo Thompson or Richard Potter, for whom the New Hampshire town of Potter Place is named? When Word of Mouth continues, uncelebrated narratives from Black history. That's after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Booker T. Washington, Marian Anderson, just a few of the powerful examples of African-American self-determination and dignity that we hear about each Black History Month, and pretty much only then. How about Bass Reeves, one of the most successful lawmen of the Old West, Marshall Taylor, at one time the fastest cyclist in the world, or Richard Potter, for whom the New Hampshire town of Potter Place is named. These are some of the unsung figures we learn about in Strange Fruit, Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History, Volume 1. It's a graphic novel with words and pictures by my guest, Joel Christian Gill. He's also Associate Dean of Student Affairs at the New Hampshire Institute of Art. And Joel Christian Gill, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, so glad you're here. Now, you grew up in the South. You later did come to Boston for grad school. What did you know of Black history growing up?
This is funny because, you know, when you grow up in the South, I actually thought my mom marched on Washington.
Didn't everybody?
I know. It was one of those things where, because when she talked about, you know, when she talked about the civil rights movement, she talked about, like, being in the middle of it. And I realized later that my mom actually lived a really sheltered life because my grandparents had a farm and she never went to town. So it was one of those things that just sort of... it made me think that my mom was a part of it. And so growing up in the South, you know, you get Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois, Mary Bethune, you know, just some random people. But, you know, I'm trying to start a thing called hashtag 28 days are not enough, because I feel like Black history is American history. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of the stories that you can't tell anywhere else because of the unique American experience and the unique sort of American cultural understanding about race and those kind of things. So
the shortest month of the year doesn't really cover it.
No, the shortest month of the year doesn't really cover it.
Well, we see something repeated in several of these 9 stories that you tell in this book. It is an American story. Racism doesn't just happen in the South, you know,
right,
where there's slavery. It follows many of these figures up north, because many of them do come from the South to the North.
Right.
Followed by these characters of these crows.
Yeah.
So, okay, obviously, we've got this visual language of Jim Crow. It looks like, to my eye. I'd love to hear about your process of sort of turning these ideas into images.
So one of my favorite books is To Kill a Mockingbird, but not for the race issue. And it's because the entire book is sort of a microcosm of one scene. And it's the scene when old Jim, the dog, is mm-hmm. walking up the street. And it's the dog that everyone loved. And everyone knew this dog. Well, Scout calls her dad and he comes out and the sheriff is there. And the sheriff can't shoot him. The sheriff can't shoot the dog because he's not as good as Atticus. So Atticus has to be the person who has to shoot the dog and put the dog out of its misery. And it's a metaphor for the entire town. Like, that's the town as a microcosm of the entire book. And I wanted to do something similar to that with the crows. I wanted you to look at a crow and think of, you know, a murder. A murder of crows is a crowd of crows. So that's a murder, right? And then they're chasing these people. And they're also Jim Crow. And so I'm taking him and I'm turning him into the racist and see how Jim Crow is actually attacking these people. And so I was thinking about that extended metaphor, and it's common in comics. There's a lot of things you can do in comics that you can't do in any other visual language. It's almost like you can take an image and you can embody it with the history of that image so that when people look at it, it's almost like a hieroglyphic. You get everything that that's supposed to be in that one image, and that's what I was trying to do with the crows.
One of the things that was shocking to me is not only learning about all these figures, and you have Alexander Crummell in New Canaan, New Hampshire.
Yes.
So not only are these stories, like, so surprising to learn them, but to learn that there is actually history of African-American life in New Hampshire, and one of them, Richard Potter. Can you tell us a little bit about this character?
Yeah, Richard Potter is sort of amazing. He was at one point considered probably the most successful American entertainer. He was born in Massachusetts. There's some haziness about where he was born. He was born about 1780s to this wealthy white man who actually educated him and at one point sent him to Europe. So he traveled to Europe for a while. When he came back, he started performing magic and he started performing these shows. And the way I try to set the story up is that his biggest illusion is to trick everybody into thinking that he was white, or he would say he was East Indian. Mm-hmm. There's a thing that magicians do naturally, which is lie. I mean, they do. Like if you go up to a magician and you say, I saw you make a whole car disappear on stage, they're going to say, yes, you did, because that's just what they do. And so there are a lot of stories about him that, like, he crawls into an oven with a ham. He comes out and ham's cooked. There's these amazing stories of him doing the Indian rope trick, which, and by what I found out, is that no one has ever done the Indian rope trick.
Tell us what that is.
That's when you take the rope up in the air and you climb the rope and you disappear at the top.
His wife used to climb it.
Yeah.
Right?
But he's like, you know, he came to New Hampshire and he bought a big plot of land. He bought a house and he lived his life. And, you know, and then Potter's Place is named after him because I think most of it was his estate. Mm-hmm. But he was this amazing person. And I always tell people, like, if I'm ever outside of New Hampshire and I'm talking about the book, I'm like, I live in New Hampshire. And so when I left, I significantly decreased the black population by leaving. So you can imagine what it was like for Richard Potter in the early 1800s when he was doing shows all up and down the East Coast.
Historical figures become the stuff of legends, right?
Yeah.
You know, we learn all this stuff. I'd love to get to Bass Reeves. People say, oh, he left a silver coin everywhere he went, or, you know, all of these other sort of legendary ideas.
You know, Bass Reeves was a former slave who got into a fight with a slave owner, punched him, and then ran away and lived in the Indian Territory. And he was there for a few years, and then he joined the Union as an irregular. And so he fought in the Union Army for a little bit, and then he left the Army and became a scout and slash posse man for the U.S. Marshals. Judge Isaac Parker, who was known as the hanging judge or the lynching judge because he lynched so many people, had an idea that most of the outlaws in the Indian Territory were white. And so the Indians didn't trust white men, whether they were outlaws, whether they were peacekeepers, didn't trust them. So he said, well, let's deputize black deputies. So Bass Reeves was one of them. And so Bass Reeves would go out into the Old West and he would come back with, you know, tons of criminals. He caught 4,000 criminals over the course of a 30-year period. And because some of his life, he would dress in disguises, he would leave a silver coin behind. And that's actually documented. There are people who say there are actual documented cases where people say he left a silver coin.
But what were some of the other legends about him?
He could spit on a brick and break it in half. he was on a mission from God. They called him the Invincible Marshal. His eulogy is unbelievable. Like, there are these amazing stories about how what an upstanding person he was, how the law was really important to him. But then it was coupled with, you know, just a generation away from being a savage, you know, mm-hmm. sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But he was a really remarkable individual. And he died in 1910 of natural causes. But he ended his life as a police officer. He was a police officer in Oklahoma. So one of the first black police officers there as well.
Joel Christian Gill is with us. He did the words and pictures for the graphic novel Strange Fruit, Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History. And we're getting just a taste of some of those. Well, some of the other stories, like Theophilus, if I'm saying that right, Theophilus Thompson, who was became a chess master, disappears. You know,
yes.
No one knows what happens to him. You know, these are the figures who were most marginalized in American history. So you can't find records. And I'm wondering if the graphic novel sort of offers you a whole way of telling stories that were never told before.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what happens with comics, is that you can tell stories in such a way that can't be told in another medium. I had a friend of mine who's a historian who said, when you think about Thomas Jefferson or you think about Thomas Paine, you never think about what pants he's wearing, right? But I have to think about that. I have to think about what pants he's wearing, what room he's sitting in, what's his facial expression, you know, how the light's going to come into the room, what time of day it is. You have to think about all those things. And when you can do that all at one time, you can use all of those things to create a mood, you know, to create, you know, metaphor. You can make it darker in some places that I think you can't do in film. And then when you use visual language, you know, which is one of the things that I've been really working on is how to use the N-word, right? Because a lot of times that's right. in there. And so what I've been doing is adding those racist caricatures of mm-hmm. black people because that's embedded
right.
with
you
all of
that
information.
Sort of big-lipped, mammy face yep. kind of pickaninny kind
yeah.
of thing.
And so I've been using those to sort of as, you know, like as a fill-in.
Right.
And when you look at that, it's like automatically you see that. You know what that means. You don't have to say it. I don't have to put in dash, dash, dash. I don't have to do anything. So here is this idea of the person that we're looking at. And here's the actual person that doesn't look anything like that. So it separates the person from those two things, mm-hmm. which you can't do in any other language. You can't
yeah.
do in any other media.
It's subtle and so effective. I just have to ask about the title, Strange Fruit, which
right.
is, of course, comes from this poem from Abel Meeropol, I
yeah.
think. He was a Jewish teacher.
Yeah.
Famously sung as a song by Billie Holiday,
right.
later Nina Simone. I've been thinking about it a lot. The lyrics have been running through my head this week, you know, and evokes kind of black bodies and
right.
off of poplar trees amid the magnolia blossoms. But these stories seem very opposite. They're about reviving something. They're about bringing life force into something. I'm just wondering why you chose the title.
I think about Strange Fruit. I did a painting in 2005, which was called Strange Fruit Harvested, and it was a self-portrait, and I had a noose around my neck, and it was frayed. And the painting, in a lot of ways, was saying things about how I'd lived in Boston. I grew up in the South, and I lived in Boston. And when I was in the South, I was never afraid to go anywhere, even though there was a Klan march in my town. And then when I moved to Boston, people are telling me, don't go to this neighborhood, don't go to that neighborhood. So this move from, you know, the South to this bastion of liberalism, and mm-hmm. I'm all of a sudden afraid to go places because of my color of my skin. So, you know, I was thinking about that, how far we've come, but how far we still have to go. And a friend of mine told me that my paintings were trying to tell stories and they were failing, which is not something that you want to hear. But that painting was the most successful one that I had done in that show. And it prompted me to go back and look at comics. And so I thought about the metaphor of Strange Fruit and how, you know, I'm touching on something, but then I'm turning it on its head. So if you think about, you know, that tree and those black bodies, I'm thinking about a different kind of tree and a different kind of black bodies in a way that these are different stories. These are stories that are on the tree of American history, but they are, you know, they're at the different places. They've fallen off the tree. They're somewhere else. You have to go looking for them. So if you have to pick them up. So I'm connecting those two things in a way, but at the same time, I'm trying to turn that idea on its head. These are stories that are strange, and they are the fruit of American history, and they also are part of this sort of American society and cultural understanding about race. And so that's why I chose the title Strange Fruit.
Well, so much rich material. I'm thinking that volume 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 are soon to follow. Joel Christian Gill, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Joel Christian Gill is Associate Dean of Student Affairs at New Hampshire Institute of Arts. He is also said to be the Chairman, CEO, President, Director of Development, Majority and Minority Stockholder, Manager, Co-Manager, Regional Manager, Assistant to the Regional Manager, et cetera, of Strange Fruit Comics. You can see a couple panels yourself from Strange Fruit, Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History, Words and Pictures by Joel Christian Gill. We'll have a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Tis the season for mosquitoes, black flies, and ticks. How are you preventing pesky bites? Up next, we're going to get some advice on a range of bug repellents, from witch hazel to DEET. We'll take a bite out of that story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The only drawback to being outdoors, hiking, gardening, swimming, or playing in New Hampshire's beautiful, precious, and short summer? Mosquitoes, black flies, horse flies, wood ticks, and of course the Lyme disease-carrying deer ticks. Ugh! These annoying pests seem bent on driving us back inside. Insect repellent comes in many flavors, but based on our completely unscientific poll of asking people in the office, most people cling to the extremes, either super organic or hardcore DEET. Here to help us choose the best bug repellent is Kira Butler. She's senior editor at Mother Jones, and she wrote the article, The Truth About Bug Spray. Kira, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
Just looking at the labels, waterproof, 12-hour, deep woods, there are so many choices. So where do we begin even choosing the best insect repellent?
Well, some of it depends on what you're planning on doing. You know, if you're going to be outside for a really long time, say on a backcountry trip, and you're going to need really, really intensive protection, then your choice is going to be different from if you're just, you know, spending a few minutes out on the lawn watching your kids play in the sprinkler.
I guess one of the shocking things in reading your article was the insect repellent labels can pretty much say anything.
That's right. You would expect a label to tell you how long a product works and what kinds of things you can do and still have the product be effective. You know, whether you can sweat a lot or go swimming. And the labels really can make all kinds of claims, and those claims are not regulated at this point. Although I should mention that the Environmental Protection Agency has drafted a label template that tells consumers what kinds of insects a product protects against and how often it needs to be reapplied. The only problem with that is that it's completely voluntary.
Wow.
So manufacturers aren't actually required to use this label.
Well, let's get to this big divide. There seems to be a question. I mean, I know a lot of people, especially on their kids, they want to use the all sort of non-harmful organic, you know, the stuff that makes bugs die of happiness, apparently, instead of landing on your skin and biting you. Are they effective?
The short answer is that we don't know, because they haven't really been studied enough for us to determine whether they have been effective. I think that some people have reservations about DEET because a bunch of years ago, there were reports of kids having seizures after using DEET. But there were a bunch of follow-up studies, and no one was ever able to make the connection between the use of DEET and those seizures. DEET has been really widely tested in laboratories, and basically, unless you're like, you know, licking the stuff and using tons of it and reapplying it, you know, every 20 minutes, it's thought to be safe, and it's also the most effective bug repellent.
DEET is thought to be safe.
Yeah, it's, you know, the Environmental Working Group, who they focus on just this kind of issues of things in the environment and how they might affect our health. You know, they look at personal care products, they look at foods, and they did a very comprehensive evaluation of all of the research on DEET and other active ingredients in bug sprays, and they found that DEET is safe.
Here in New Hampshire, we do have, in New England, we have a serious deer tick problem and a very high rate of Lyme disease. Any recommendations for keeping ticks off of us?
Yeah, the deer tick problem is a really big one, especially in the Northeast. And the CDC does recommend products containing DEET for that. I hate to sound like a broken record here, but, you know, the DEET really does seem to be the most effective for ticks.
So, Kira, after looking at several different insect repellents and their ingredients, can you tell us what we would want in an insect repellent and what we probably wouldn't?
Well, in terms of ingredients that you would want, DEET I've already mentioned, and then there are two other ones. There's picaridin, which is the active ingredient in most Avon SkinSoSoft products, and then there's IR3535, which isn't exactly the sexiest name, but it's also thought to be really effective. In terms of ingredients that you should steer clear of, a lot of people think that plant-based and organic ingredients sound really good. I found one in my reporting for this piece that claimed it had a proprietary blend of citrus fruit, warm cedarwood, and silken vanilla, which probably smells really good and sounds really nice. But unfortunately, these plant-based ingredients really have not been adequately tested for their efficacy.
I just love that it's silken vanilla.
Right, as if that's a different plant than regular vanilla.
Well, Kira Butler, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
Kira Butler, senior editor at Mother Jones. She wrote the article, The Truth About Bug Spray, and you'll find a link to read the full article at wordofmouthradio.org. We'd love to know if you have a tried and true bug spray that works. Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. While bugs make some people recoil in disgust, for John Jay, those creepy crawlies evoke loving memories of his father. Jay Allison brings us the story of insects, family, and tradition.
This will give you a little idea of the largest and the most beautiful and the most unusual creatures of this kind in the world in the May Natural History Museum here. That's quite a thing, isn't it, that stick insect? When they fly, they sound just like a toy. This is a Mygale tarantula, and these spiders are known to catch birds and mice. This is one of the world's largest katydids. That's about 10 inches across. You look at the grasshoppers. I would show you some on the back wall here. They have absolutely gorgeous rainbow colors on them. These are all weevils. You wouldn't think weevils were that beautiful, would you? It's just a little fellow that gives all the trouble in the cotton. There's some more of our beetles, and look at that for gold. It's almost unreal. I was born with this. I would see, my dad was doing this kind of thing as far back as I can remember. And I can remember the packages coming in from the tropics sometimes, and we were in a cold country up in Canada where we lived. And I remember how excited he would be when these packages would come in. He said, Ian, you call me from another room, you know, and come and see what's here, you know. We would have these morpho butterflies, and we would have something that was really spectacular. And he was just one of these. He was one of the really great old-time naturalists. I've seen Dad collect butterflies all day. He had a tremendous constitution. Then we would go home, maybe have supper where we lived, and then we would start out and take a 20-mile trip, which was a big trip in the days of the first cars, you know, back in the 20s and the early 30s. And then we would drive 20 miles, and we'd get the traps all set up just before it got dark. As you know, it stays light longer in Canada than it does down here. Sometimes it doesn't get dark till 10 o'clock. And he would set those traps up, and I would stay up as long as I could, but I would go to bed at least probably around 11. I can remember I would wake up. It would get cold, damp and cold. I'd wake up, and sure enough, Dad would be over at the traps. They're picking off the really good ones that were coming in. These are the morpho butterflies, and as you walk by them, you see the colors change. And some of those butterflies can be seen flashing in the canopy of the jungle up high. If you're flying over the jungle in an airplane, and say you're within a half a mile, you see these flashes down below, and you think somebody with a mirror down there, and it isn't at all. It's these butterflies flying around. They'll flash the sunlight just like a mirror. He always loved the morpho butterflies. When my dad died, I was in the hospital with him. And the last thing that he ever said, he said, Ian, isn't that a beautiful case of morpho? And he died just a few minutes after that. I'm the son of James F.W. May. He said, Ian, I worked with him ever since I was a young boy. Isn't that a beautiful case of morpho? You see these flashes down below, and you think somebody with a mirror down there, and it isn't at all. It's these butterflies flying around.
That story was one of Jay Allison's vintage pieces produced in the 1980s. Happy to have you join us today. If you like what you heard, there is much more to listen to and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share some of the things that you're hearing about on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.